Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, now celebrating their 125th anniversary. From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. The LSU Ag Center wants to reach out to you. Their members have fostered agricultural, engineering, and scientific programs across the state, many of which might be in your neighborhood. On this week's Louisiana Eats, we go across the state to hear how Ag Agent Grace Peterson is connecting Shreveport residents with regional food. And we'll cultivate tomatoes with Bobby Fletcher near the Mississippi River. Then we'll float downstream with Professor John Bell to learn how the Louisiana oyster can help rebuild coastal wetlands. We travel from the Gulf of Mexico to Shreveport's urban farms on this week's Louisiana Eats. The Shreveport food scene is really on the move. Some of the most innovative work designed to provide fresh food access is happening in urban locations all across the city.
My name is Grace Peterson. I'm an extension agent with the LSU Ag Center, and I work with youth and community gardens around the Shreveport-Bossier area, and I also work with establishing a healthy regional food system for the Arklatex.
That's the tri-state area of Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas, which Grace knows very well. She leads a team at the Valencia Youth Garden and Urban Farm in Shreveport, one of 15 gardens she manages in the area. As you can imagine, that amount of work keeps her busy.
The programming we do here is pretty extensive. We offer after-school programs for kids of all ages. What that brings in is gardening lessons, cooking lessons, and lessons about the food system so that the teenagers understand what it takes all the way from seed to plate, and also what are the barriers to access to nutritious food. And we've identified that there's four major barriers. One is physical access, which would be food deserts. There's not a healthful food outlet in your neighborhood. Financial access, maybe you can't afford nutritious food. And two knowledge barriers, one being the knowledge of what to eat that's healthy, and the other is how to prepare it in a healthy way. So we help the teenagers and the younger kids learn this.
When you meet Grace, it's apparent that she's laid back. She's got a wonderfully disarming presence and a practical sensibility to match. Grace is helping solve legitimate problems in many of Shreveport's underserved communities. Here she is touring the garden.
You know, what I find, you know, I'm not originally from Shreveport, but I've been here for 25 years now, and I find that once people really understand the issues, they're very generous with time and money. But I find that the environment's very receptive, and I think great things are happening. In fact, what I see here is that we're able to have a concerted effort towards the food system, the regional food system, and some of these programs because people are really working together.
And of all the things Grace is working on, that regional food system might be the biggest.
If we're ever going to get farm to institution, more farm to restaurant, we need to look at a systems approach to that. First, we look at the food system and how can that system be supported on a regional level so that we can support more food producers and then get to that point where food is available at many, many outlets.
Those ambitions have a long way to go, so Grace focuses on the neighborhood level first.
And what we found when we started looking into that is we've lost the infrastructure for the processing and distribution of regionally grown food. You know, we have a farmer's market, which is really great. But if we're going to get it to where enough can go into schools and institutions, then we need a regional food hub, like a wholesale hub, where food can be aggregated, processed, packaged, and then distributed. And when you look at a regional food system, you're typically looking at a metropolitan center and then 100 miles out. So for us, it's Shreveport-Bossier and what's called the Arklatex. So we're going to be looking at how do we work with three states to do that, and how can we really get funding to get this regional food hub, but also starting at the neighborhood level so that we can help people understand the issues and provide education so that the general public can advocate for a healthy regional food system. So we're developing these neighborhood food hubs such as Valencia and Highland, where we can really provide programming so that people understand the issues and then they can become advocates and spokespeople for the development of this system.
Those pragmatic ideas have attracted people to the Valencia Youth Garden since it was founded 5 years ago. In that time, Grace has seen all kinds of transformations take place. A lot of them are because of her, like the way she got kids to enjoy vegetables, something parents often try to do but usually fail at.
Well, you know, one of the best things that we've done is use a taste test form. And so whenever they're trying something new, you know, well, first of all, we had to outlaw the word nasty. Like, no, we're not going to talk about our food that way, because a lot of people look at it and decide they don't like it before they even try it. So we have this form. And so I said, okay, before you decide anything, you look and you get to judge this on a scale of 1 to 5 on the color. Do you like the way it looks? And they can judge that. And now, nope, don't eat it yet. Now smell it. Do you like the way it smells? And then we talk about texture, and they put it in their mouth and decide if they like the texture and then the taste. So it gives them the control and also lets them decide and get their senses involved in it before they just make a blanket decision that they don't care for it. They can really start interacting and forming that relationship with something new.
But the adults are another story.
Kids are very interested in growing things and preparing that, but adults who've never gardened before seem to not be so interested. So I found that it's works better to bring them in through the fresh food aspect of it. And so one program we've done to bring in the families is a veggie of the month, where we invite the families to come and actually harvest a crop and then go up and all prepare it together. And as a way to encourage the adults to get more involved in the garden. Another challenge has been that sometimes the kids learn how to cook, but they're not making the choices at the grocery store. So we give them a certificate to take home that tells what they know how to do in the kitchen, and take home some recipes, and also take home, you know, ingredients that we have from the garden, and encourage the parents to purchase the rest for that recipe.
Grace hopes that increasing the awareness of what's communally available will also increase the demand of those foods. With one unexpected challenge after another, the job is far from glamorous. But when things go well, it's got its perks.
You know, once they get involved with it and really start tasting these things, it does seem that that they are making changes. It's just that, you know, changing what we eat doesn't happen quickly. So I always think in baby steps. And, you know, if one of the first thing that families do is add fresh vegetables from the garden to their ramen, making a vegetable soup, I think that's a step in the right direction. And we encourage those kind of small steps. The whole culture of this community center has changed around food, and the peer pressure is towards the garden and towards trying new things. And it's great to hear the kids now, when new ones come in, the ones who've been involved in the program will say, oh no, we don't say that about our food. No, and how are you going to know if you don't try it? And so they're starting to say those kind of things. It's baby steps, it is. But progress, yay.
That's Grace Peterson, member of the LSU Ag Center and leader of the Valencia Youth Gardens and Urban Farms in Shreveport. Since we last spoke with her, Grace has received a grant from the USDA, which will expand the organization into 3 more community centers in Shreveport. Visit our website at wwno.org for a link to their blog. As Grace Peterson can tell you, building a regional food hub from the ground up is hard work. But if you live in New Orleans, you're lucky, because there's already an infrastructure in place. food hubs like the Crescent City Farmers Market, Holly Grove Market and Farm, and Good Eggs makes it easy for us to connect with local food directly. Earlier this year, we visited the new Good Eggs warehouse to speak with Tess Monahan and Simone Reggie about the growth this online aggregator has experienced.
2 years ago in San Francisco, our founders got together with some local farmers to see what was a challenge that they were facing. And they said since it's such a technology and internet-based world, they could come up with some sort of software where people could order their products and then they could handle the delivery. And so that worked beautifully for them. And then about a year later, they followed up and said, how is it going? I said, it's great. It's just we don't have time to deliver. So if you could possibly aggregate the orders and deliver them for us, that would be great. So hence an internet company turned into a distribution company.
To me, what that reflects is that people are starting to see that our food system needs to change. And the way we think about the kind of fundamental way that we feed ourselves is pretty broken in the United States. And I'm not sure we are the answer. You know, we are certainly not the only answer. But we're definitely pushing the envelope as far as encouraging people to think differently about where they spend their money on food. And so I'm hoping that as 2014 progresses, we see more and more people thinking about, well, yes, I could just go to the supermarket. I could just, you know, buy some organic food where, yes, it's organic, but it's owned by the same Nestle or Kraft or Unilever that owns all the non-organic brands also. And maybe is that where I want to put my money? Or in some way or another, do I want to put my money into the local economy and into the pockets of local farmers and food businesses?
You know, it is so interesting the way New Orleans commerce is just growing by leaps and bounds in a variety of huge ways. Like, nobody can believe how many restaurants there are. No restaurants closing. Everybody just opening. And about the same time that you all really got rolling, we got our first Costco. So give me the Costco versus Good Eggs comparison. There really isn't a comparison, is there?
It's pretty different. I think that all in all, more options are better for people. As far as big box stores go, Costco has a pretty great track record. They treat their employees well. They make an effort to get organic products and to source better than comparable stores. I don't think we're ever going to sell giant volumes of, you know, dish detergent or paper towels. So people are free to continue to go to Costco for their bulk staples. but I think that there's a growing awareness of, you know, okay, what things do I want to buy from the mass market system and what things do I want to buy from sources where I really know, you know, really know where the food is coming from, really know where the product is coming from.
Yeah, I definitely think that's what sets us apart from any grocery store in town is that you can, when you go on the site, you look and you see, like, I am buying a pie from Nate the Pie Guy, or I am buying milk from the Motes, and you know exactly who they are. You can click on their link. It tells their story. So it gives you that personal connection to your food. Like, I know Tess posted a picture last night on Instagram, and there have been so many times where I've done it where I look down at my plate and I personally know every single person involved in that whole meal. And it's a complex meal. It's not like two ingredients. It's like 15 ingredients. There's something rewarding about that. There's something different about that than any other experience that you have.
I have a logistics question because in some ways you all are really like a grocery store now, but all the ordering has to be done online first. So what if suddenly you're hungry for some of Dan S.'s puttanesca sauce? How quick can you get your hands on it?
Ordering is typically 32 hours in advance. So that means you order by midnight Sunday, let's say, for Tuesday delivery, midnight Monday for Wednesday delivery, etc.
And that doesn't change for pickup here.
No, it's the same because almost all of our products are what we call just-in-time fulfillment, which means that it's actually a really amazing system that reduces a lot of waste because what it means is, you know, if Tim has 3 heads of broccoli for order today, he is going to pick those 3 heads of broccoli this morning, or maybe he picked them last night, but it's not even like a farmer's market where you're going to pick 20 heads of broccoli and then maybe 5 of them will sell, or maybe none of them will sell, or maybe 20 will sell. So a lot of what we're doing is reducing waste by just making sure that we're only bringing into our warehouse exactly what's already been sold. There's so much waste in our food system. Grocery stores create so much food waste. A lot of the time it's products that are, you know, just one day before their expiration date, so they can't use them. Even though the product's still good, they can't sell it. So what we're trying to do, in addition to creating connections between local farmers and the customer, is reduce food waste in the system and create a more efficient distribution system.
Since Good Eggs started in California and you all are part of a larger organization, would you talk to me a little bit about how the business model works, in that how much is from inspiration and instruction from California and how much are you all growing locally, organically here at Good Eggs New Orleans?
So the team in California, we're extremely lucky that they have a large engineering team that created a lot of software resources for us. So fundamentally, the way that we're able to do what we do in an efficient way is because of this amazing software that the team has built, which allows customers to place orders online and then provides a whole lot of tools on the back end for us to see the orders as they come in, for the farmers to manage their orders, for us to be able to say, okay, this is the delivery route for today, this is how many delivery drivers we're going to need. And without that software, we would not be able to do what we're doing. That's a big part of why we're successful. As far as, you know, the day-to-day operations, we are clearly very much in talks with the San Francisco office, you know, every day, every week. We have teams here that have counterparts in San Francisco. So, for example, Simone is the lead of our food maker team here. There's a food maker team in every city. There's one in Los Angeles. There's one in New York. And a lot of things, a lot of the challenges that our food makers, our farmers, and our food producers face locally are echoed in the other cities. But we also have unique challenges. So I would say that our relationship with the headquarters in San Francisco is very supportive. They really support us. They're there to build tools that will make us succeed, make us be able to support our local food system better. There have been very few times when they've said, no, you can't do this, or yes, you must do this. It's been a pretty smooth course of action.
What do you expect is coming next from Good Eggs?
We would like to continue to expand our delivery radius and just keep adding more convenient pickup and delivery options for people so they can get their food in a way that's really convenient for them.
Yeah, it's been really exciting. Recently, we've launched into Metairie and Algiers. And so that's been huge, and people have really been receptive to that. So as soon as we get the word out, more and more people can have, because there's no farmers market in Metairie.
Right.
And so this is perfect for the people of Metairie, I think.
Well, thank you so much for letting us come over here, meet the vendors, see the food coming in the door, and really get a hands-on experience about how the whole Good Eggs program really works. Congratulations.
Thank you, Poppy.
Thank you for coming to visit us.
That was Tess Monahan and Simone Reggie of Good Eggs, an online food aggregator in Louisiana. More information is available online at goodeggs.com/NOLA. When we come back from a short break, we'll take you to the most unlikely heirloom tomato plot in the whole state of Louisiana. Don't go anywhere.
I got rhythm all in my shoe. So from the south and the blue. Well, come on, baby, come along with me.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's.
Come on, baby, come along with me. Taste
so. You want to know what's happening in the food scene of North Louisiana? Just ask our roving reporter, Chris Jay. Chris, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again, Poppy.
So where are we going today?
Well, this is a little bit unusual. I wanted to tell you about a place called the Cookhouse at Cohab. It's a culinary incubator that just opened up in downtown Shreveport. So it's like a plug-and-play kitchen and restaurant space for budding food entrepreneurs.
So what goes on there?
That's what's so wonderful about it. You never know from day to day what's going to pop up, literally. You know, it might be a Mexican-style street food. It might be a chef making her pralines. You never know. And it's got a commercial kitchen. It's got its own seating and dining area. It's really affordable for local budding food entrepreneurs to just rent the space for a day.
So you just happen by and see what's being served?
Or follow them on Facebook. It's a cookhouse at Cohab, and locals just kind of follow them, and people are just learning in Shreveport-Bossier to enjoy this pop-up phenomenon. I've had lunch there. I've had dinner there. I've gone to an evening class called Garrett Johnson's Tea Series, where a young man taught about the history of the world's teas and then served tea with each course that he was teaching, which he needed access to a commercial kitchen to legally be able to do. So the space has made all of these kind of random food and drink related events possible that weren't possible before.
And I guess also it sounds like people are doing food production there for resale, because
absolutely,
of course you need a certified commercial kitchen to be able to do that. What sort of food products have you seen coming out of there for retail, and where can people find them?
Well, for example, I know of several who have been using the space recently. A lady named Darty, who calls herself the Queen of Pralines, is using the kitchen to manufacture her pralines. My friend Pandorina Sumas, who owns Sumas Heritage Creole Creations, which is like prepackaged Creole food mixes, she's using the space for some of her needs. It's made a lot of things possible for people that don't have the resources to kind of go big, but they want to dip their toe in it and see if there's an audience for their products.
That's a fantastic asset for Shreveport.
Absolutely. And I think it's teaching Shreveport-Bossier folks to be a little more open-minded and try things that they may not be that comfortable or familiar with. Things are changing so quickly, and it's got a lot to do with the rest of Louisiana, making us feel like we need to step our game up and become a cooler place to be and to eat.
Well, thank you so much for always keeping us right on the cutting edge of the food scene of North Louisiana. Thanks, Chris.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Poppy.
Chris J., our Louisiana Eats roving reporter. It may surprise you that every citizen of Louisiana has access to the LSU Ag Center. They've set up cooperative services in all 64 parishes of the state, each run by experts familiar with the community. Bobby Fletcher is one of those agents. His scientific research teaches urban dwellers how to grow food in a limited amount of space. We joined him on site near the New Orleans Convention Center.
Hi, I'm Bobby Fletcher with the LSU Ag Center. We're actually standing on the corner of Chapatulas and Henderson Streets, which basically is the old entrance of the World's Fair from 1984, where Neptune and the alligator are posed. We have about a 2/10 of an acre, we'll call it an urban vegetable farm here, although we do have some watermelons out here as well. And then at this location, we have a much larger plot set up for demonstration with other vegetables, bell peppers, we have watermelons, some different herbs that we have here that we're growing at this particular location. And all of that is basically to increase awareness of the LSU Ag Center. Even though you're in an urban area, we want to have a location in downtown New Orleans where the people that are driving by can start seeing this and watch it grow.
Well, this is how you get on the Greater New Orleans Bridge.
Right.
That's your number one approach from uptown. So
absolutely. And there's about 8 rows here that are about 150 feet long. Typically, they'd be 4 feet apart. But for these purposes, we have them 8 feet apart where we can get in between. A small home gardener can grow, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 tomato plants or bell peppers or eggplants in a small area and get a lot of production. And on an average, if you have one of the recommended varieties of tomatoes, they'll yield anywhere from 10 to 20 pounds of tomatoes. So if you have 10 plants, you can yield 100 to 200 pounds of vine ripened tomatoes. And then we're taking all this produce that we're growing and we're donating that back into the community.
Oh, that's a wonderful thing, because when you were describing the yield of the garden, I thought, well, somebody who's growing a garden of this sort of production level, you're either going to have to take up canning Or you're going to make a lot of beloved neighbor friends, aren't you?
Absolutely. Or, you know, some folks even could consider becoming a vendor at one of the farmers markets here. And really the ultimate goal of this is we're comparing poultry litter, which is an organic form of fertilizer, to conventional fertilizer with our tomatoes. And we're comparing it to two different levels of poultry litter. One of those is equal to the conventional fertilizer, so we can compare apples to apples. Of course, we're going to do an economic assessment on the yield, and that's what we're going to be doing here later this morning, is actually harvesting each plot independently and identifying the quality of the fruit, the weight of the fruit, the grade of the fruit. And we've done that three times already, and we'll do it two or three more times. So we're going to do this for 2 years, and then we'll have some comparative data from an organic fertility standpoint to compare that to conventional fertilizer. So it's really our first shot at doing something from an organic standpoint, from a fertility standpoint, and hopefully we'll be able to expand that into other organic best practices as we move forward, because there's very little data, research-based data, that's out there that compares organic fertility to conventional fertilizer.
Yeah, it would be my guess that when you started in this 25 years ago, nobody cared too much about organic anything.
Yeah, I would say in the last probably 10 years, that's been a trend that's been enhancing. So,
well, would you take us on a tour and tell us what varieties you've got?
Sure.
I'm particularly curious about the Bella Rosa tomato.
Yes.
Why was that variety selected in particular?
That's a recommended variety on the LSU Ag Center list of varieties of tomatoes. And it's also a large size quality, and it has good flavor. The advantage of being able to vine ripen a tomato as opposed to harvesting it green and then ripening it through other processes is that the flavor is not there. You know, we're about, you know, maybe an eighth of a mile from the Mississippi River right where we are, so this is an alluvial soil. It's not a Creole variety tomato, but being grown in the alluvial soil, it's actually what
it
we
qualifies.
Call a Creole tomato. And you can vine ripen it. And if you look at the way this is laid out, you think of tying tomatoes on a wooden stake. Most people just tie one tomato on a wooden stake. This is what we call a trellis weave system of tying a determinate variety of tomatoes. And a determinate just means it's only going to get so high.
Yes.
This is something that's much easier to manage. We do have some T-posts, which are just some metal posts that we have on the ends and about every 20 or so feet. And we just have some 3/8-inch rebar about every third or fourth tomato plant. So we don't tie to every plant. We tie it around the rebar, and we run a string down one side of the row, come back down the other side of the row. So we basically have a string on both sides of the tomato. So you never have to really touch the tomato to tie it to a wooden stake or whatever the case may be. So from a best management standpoint and a time-saving standpoint, it's a practice that saves time and saves money and labor, and it serves the same process. And when these tomatoes are finished, if we want to come in and grow cucumbers or something else that's more of a vining type vegetable, we already have a trellis that's already built in. So we use the same irrigation system, we use the same mulch, and we can do at least two crops. We can do a spring crop, we're going to do a summer crop, and actually you want to do a fall crop, you can actually get three crops in.
It seems very gentle and non-invasive, because basically instead of tying plants up as people are accustomed to doing, they're just sort of being gently held between those two strings, and so it's almost like they're just naturally holding themselves up.
Right, and then you have a string about every 8 to 12 inches, depending on how vigorous the plant's growing. So you do have to come back episodically every week or so when the plant grows and put another string to keep up with it, where you don't have the top falling over, those type of things. So it's really a good management practice. It's something that a home gardener can do. In an urban area, you can see these balconies over here across the street.
Yeah.
Some people have plants in containers. You know, if you have a little courtyard or patio, you can grow a tomato in a container. Get several containers. You know, if you got five, you know, that's 50 to 100 pounds of tomatoes you can produce, right? So just on a little balcony just right across the street of this housing here. So regardless of how much space you have, whether you want have a 10 by 10 area or you have 10 containers that you can grow vegetables in, you can produce a lot of fruit. And you can have something growing pretty much every month of the year in Louisiana. And that's a great thing. The big disadvantage is that if you have 4.5 or 5 inches of rain in 4 or 5 days, and then it just keeps raining like this pattern we've been in, and you don't have good internal soil drainage, or you don't have it in a container, that's when you start having big issues with more insects and disease problems. So that's the biggest disadvantage, and probably why we don't see as much commercial vegetable production on a larger scale in Louisiana, because the environmental conditions, although they're conducive and great for growing conditions, the moisture we get sometimes, you know, we may go 2 months with 2 inches of rain. We may go 2 months with 20 inches of rain. So yeah. It's not all spread out uniformly throughout the growing season. So raised beds, drip irrigation, organic or inorganic type mulch, putting them in a container, you can manage that a whole lot easier than having to depend on Mother Nature to give you a uniform distribution of 1 to 2 inches of rainfall per week.
So how can people go about arranging visits to demonstration plots?
Typically, we have a field day. We'll do a field day connected to a demonstration. I was an area horticulture agent for 10 years over Lafourche, Terrebonne, and St. Mary. And we did a tomato field day every year with a commercial grower where it would be set up similar to what this is. And then we come out usually about this time of the year. We do some educational programs, and we go out into the field and walk through just like we're doing right now. We look at all the different varieties. Of course, we'd have multiple varieties as opposed to this case. Because it's a research project, we have one variety that we're trying to compare because we want to get this data published. We're going to connect this as a demonstration and research project to Farm to Table, and we're hoping to have some tours that are engaged with the Farm to Table International Symposium that's going to be here at the Convention Center August the 2nd through the 4th.
Well, thank you, Dr. Fletcher. This has been such a treat getting to visit you in this very urban setting with this delicious-looking produce growing everywhere. Good job.
Thanks. And we're going to harvest some tomatoes if y'all want to hang around a little while and get some photos of that.
Okay. Thank you. That was Bobby Fletcher, Regional Director of the LSU Ag Center. To find out what local agents are doing in your parish, visit lsuagcenter.com. Scott Gold has encountered and written about a variety of different foods in his career, but every once in a while, he comes across something that even he's unfamiliar with. Here, Scott talks about his discovery of two ingredients previously unknown to him and just how geeky food can get.
As an eater with a broad and adventurous appetite, I'm constantly on the lookout for something new. One food I discovered in recent years is Romanesco. Otherwise known as Roman broccoli or broccaflower, its distinctive spiral florets, pale green color, crunchy texture, and mild nutty flavor found their way onto a plate at Maurepas Foods when I dined there some time ago. It was delightful. Vegetal, but not overpoweringly so, tasting somewhere between cauliflower and broccoli, hence the name. But what I loved best were its crazy little conical spirals. They looked like something Dr. Seuss might have come up with had God given him a whack at inventing vegetables. I didn't realize just how weird, wonderful, and truly nerdy Romanesco was until I saw a whole head of one while shopping at the Crescent City Farmers Market. Despite the vegetable's Italian origins, Timmy Perilou of Perilou Farms grows them in the wintertime just outside of New Orleans. I was immediately struck by the outrageous shape of the thing, the dizzying, exotic form of the florets twisting into tight, spiky cones like a vegetable from outer space. As it turns out, Romanesco is also known as fractal broccoli, because its shape approximates that of a natural fractal. This is where things get really nerdy. A fractal, if you don't remember from math class, is a mathematical set that typically displays self-similar patterns, and that includes the idea of a detailed pattern repeating itself. And here we have Romanesco, a living, delicious representation of fractal geometry, not to mention the Fibonacci series and the famed golden ratio, grown on a South Louisiana farm, ready to be roasted with a little salt, pepper, and olive oil. Can food possibly get any nerdier than this? Yes, it can. Another of my recent discoveries in the realm of truly geeky ingredients is the Kiwano melon. I saw them sitting there at my local Rouse's Market, strange, spiky things that looked like the offspring of an orange and a lemon that had armed themselves to the teeth. What in God's name is this all about? I asked myself aloud, and knew immediately that I needed to investigate. I purchased a pair of the melons, doing my best not to injure myself on those hard spikes on the bike ride home. Kiwano, I imagine, probably ranks right behind durian on the list of flora one would choose to employ for self-defense in a combat-type situation. There are some interesting facts about the kiwano that I discovered in my initial research. Like Romanesco, it goes by a number of aliases. Horned melon, jelly melon, hedged gourd, African horned cucumber, melano, and, my favorite, blowfish fruit, as it is apparently known in the southeastern United States. Because, yeah, it looks just like a blowfish. Apparently, while the Kiwano originates from New Zealand, it's been appropriated by farmers in Mississippi, so close to our Louisiana home. But that's just surface stuff. Things become even more nerdy and fascinating when you cut the bizarre thing open and find out what it looks like on the inside. It's vibrant green, gelatinous, and filled with seeds like a tomato. Who knew such things existed? Then there's the flavor. Once you get past those pesky seeds, it's somewhere between a cucumber and a sour banana, a combination for which I was unprepared. It's not bad, though I found it hard to justify the price outside of the novelty factor. But what truly makes this possibly the nerdiest fruit around is that, believe it or not, it appeared on an episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Producers of the show found the Kiwano so crazy-looking, both inside and out, they chose it to represent an otherworldly Golana melon in the episode Time's Orphan. Talk about some serious geek cred. So, my nerdy friends, I urge you to live long and prosper. And don't forget to eat your vegetables.
That was food writer and native New Orleanian Scott Gold. His Food Porn Fridays column can be found each week at nolavie.com. When we come back from the next break, we'll speak with Professor John Bell about the Louisiana oyster. Do you know the difference between a washed oyster and an unwashed one? It can make all the difference when you buy shucked oysters. The answer's coming up after the break. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Market. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. Do you know the difference between a washed oyster and an unwashed one? When oysters are shucked, it's standard procedure for them to be rinsed with a fine mist of water before packing. But a freshly shucked oyster is still alive and can absorb some of that rinsing water, diluting its natural saltiness. Luckily in Louisiana, there are opportunities for buying your oysters unwashed, but if you have no choice, you should lightly poach them before adding them to your dish, because a washed oyster expels that extra water as soon as it hits the heat. To poach them, I put washed oysters and their liquor in a saucepan over a medium-high heat and carefully stir them with my hand. When it's too hot for my hand in the pot, the oysters are done and must be removed from the heat immediately to avoid overcooking. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. With each passing year, coastal restoration becomes a major environmental and cultural issue in our state. Thousands are looking for a solution to the problem, including scientists, academics, and even oystermen. Each spring, the Louisiana Oyster Industry Convention meets to share information about our state's favorite bivalve, an event that Professor John Bell attends religiously. He's primarily interested in the safety of seafood, but has learned that the future of our environment could be affected by the oyster.
Eating oysters in Louisiana is a major part of our culture here. Whether it's raw or fried or now char-grilled, the oyster industry is it's probably not as huge as other aspects of the different food industries, but it's a very important one and it employs a lot of people and impacts a lot of people. The environmental part, that's really the bigger question, and I don't think anybody has one answer for that. How things are going to change for the better as we try to restore our wetlands are going to have a significant impact not only on the oyster harvester and the business, but also on the rest of us consumers who like to eat oysters. That needs to be taken into consideration, like many other factors, as we move forward to restore our coastlines. One topic that came up that kind of impressed me was this idea of save our reefs. It's kind of a movement started by John Tesfitch. And he pointed out that there are some oyster reefs out in our wetlands that have been there for centuries. It's really just unique parts of nature, if you will, similar to like the Florida Everglades is a point he was making, and beautiful coral reefs. People aren't aware of them, and his concept should be that the existence of those reefs and the continued existence of those reefs should be a consideration in the master plan when they come to determining where river diversions might be and those type of issues. It was really interesting to hear him talk. It was something I'd never realized myself. These are just wondrous, you know, reefs and the collections of oysters. Recently read a report where a very large percentage of the world's oyster reefs no longer are in existence. So it really is a timely topic.
This is a great national treasure we've got there in the waters, then.
That's the word he used, exactly.
How does the oyster spat affect the restoration?
Well, again, this is just from my understanding of listening to oyster biologists and wetland experts talk. But the main idea is it does two things. It'll form a structure, actually reefs, and that'll have some impact on water movement and can actually afford some protection to growing plants as we're trying to build land. So that's one aspect. And the second one is they filter water. I mean, that's how they grow. That's what they do. They clean up water, and that can have a big impact on helping the environment, nourishing not only the wetlands and the growing grasses, but provide cover for fish and other environments, other animals. So it produces benefits in many ways, but specifically for the restoration, I think, is producing some structure that will help with the growing back and building land. Personally, I don't want to see the oyster industry go away. I don't think anybody wants to. It's just going to have to adapt as it has in the past, and the voices need to be heard.
Something I learned about recently is an oyster hatchery that's opening up on Grand Isle, and it's just brand new and coming on board. Tell us about a plan for an oyster hatchery on Grand Isle.
From my understanding, they've really added a couple focuses to what they were doing. They're always doing oyster research and trying to support the industry in the biological aspects. But one thing they're doing, Dr. Supan, is as an outgrowth of some of this research, they've been able to develop oysters that will grow fat and not reproduce during the summer months. So this provides an opportunity for interested fishermen, so it's focusing on the fishermen in the industry, the harvesters, to be able, if they want to try and produce that type of oyster during the summer months. That's really kind of nascent right now. I think there's one or two guys attempting it here. They're also working on it in Alabama. But that's an exciting issue for the hatchery to focus on directly helping the industry.
Is this a genetically modified oyster?
It's the traditional crossbreeding. Okay, and let me make sure I get this right. It has triploid, meaning it has three sets of chromosomes instead of two. So that means that it's sterile. So instead of putting energies in reproducing, it just grows.
Now, the old rule of thumb was always that you could only eat oysters in months that have an R. But here, we can eat them year-round now, right?
That's true. I think that comes from, certainly it's a historical comment or saying, and that tends to go with because in many places, those are the summer months and the water gets warmer and there are pollution concerns that if there are pollution concerns, things just grow faster when it's warmer. Every state, much less Louisiana certainly, has state-level controls of monitoring of the growing waters to control pollution at any time it might happen. And the other aspect about the months with an R is that the warmer summer months are generally where the oysters reproduce. And so their energy isn't into growing and storing up energy. That's when they're putting the energy to reproduction so that they become a more watery organism and just not as tasty.
Yeah, they get like a little milky somehow.
That's true. I mean, I think that they can still eat them fried, although there are a lot of people who won't even eat them fried. But certainly when it comes to eating them raw, I much prefer oysters in the winter when they're nice and fat.
Thank you, John, for coming to talk with me and filling in all of our Louisiana Eats oyster eaters on the state of the Louisiana oyster.
Well, it's my pleasure, Poppy. I'd love to come back anytime you want.
Dr. John Bell, seafood specialist for the Louisiana Sea Grant College Program. got high cholesterol, your doctor probably told you to stop eating red meat, eggs, and shellfish. But scientific research is now telling us otherwise. Serum cholesterol, found in blood, is not affected by the amount of dietary cholesterol that you eat, at least not for most people. So how will these scientific changes impact your plate? Our friend Dr. Gourmet is here with the answer.
There was a time when we thought that cholesterol, dietary cholesterol, the type of cholesterol that you get when you consume something, when you eat something, like shrimp or lobster or crawfish or even chicken livers, that was bad for you. And it raised your serum cholesterol, the cholesterol circulating in your bloodstream. But we know now that that's not true for the vast majority of us. Most of us can eat all of the dietary cholesterol we want without really serious problems and it raising our cholesterol. You don't have to worry about delicious Louisiana shrimp.
And what about other shellfish? Does this rule carry through?
Crawfish is the same. Lobster, crabs, they are high in cholesterol. So about 4 ounces of shrimp has 200 milligrams of cholesterol. And that used to be really near the limit of what you were supposed to have every day. The nice thing about it is that's, you know, that shrimp at 4 ounces is really low in calories. It doesn't have many calories, great quality protein, very low in fat, very low in saturated fat. So it's a great choice for dinner once or maybe even twice a week, especially in the season.
I guess a lot of it depends on how you cook it.
Some of it depends on how you cook it, yeah. You know, I think that if you're, you know, fried shrimp every now and then is okay, but fried shrimp every time, maybe not so much a good idea because of the added saturated fat and other fats, which we do know has some effect on our risk. But, you know, there's so many great ways to do shrimp. You know, you can saute in garlic. You can make shrimp kebabs, steamed shrimp. You can do a shrimp boil, like a crawfish boil. I mean, there's so many great recipes out there that you can choose.
What about if you begin to add sauces?
Well, you know, sauces are going to be the same thing. Keep in mind, and you and I have talked about this before, that when you're thinking about a recipe, you want to think about calorie density. And the total amount of calories that are going into the food you're going to consume. So a really, really rich sauce every now and then with your shrimp is an okay choice, just like the fried shrimp every now and then is okay choice. But the rest of the time, you know, sautéed shrimp, you know, a little bit of shrimp sautéed in some olive oil and maybe even a little touch of butter and some garlic and some spring onions and some peas, and you toss that in sauté and you put that over some rice or pasta. I mean, that's a fantastic meal. And again, even though it's got cholesterol in it, it's not bad for you.
Do you have any favorite sauces?
Well, classic remoulade is you know, what you should have with shrimp. And, you know, making a chopped salad with a little remoulade sauce is a great idea. Shrimp, some veggies, lots and lots and lots of veggies, your choice of lettuce or spinach, and then some remoulade sauce toss. That's a fantastic meal. It's all about that balance.
Well, I feel so much better about that shrimp boil I'm having next week. So thank you, Tim. Thanks so much for demystifying always the medical questions between what's on our plate and what's happening in our bodies. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Poppy.
Dr. Gourmet, Tim Harlan. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week for a chat with Chef Ben Thibodeau about the new regime that's helped him lose weight and develop healthy eating habits.
I never cared about the weight. It was that was never a factor for me. It was everything that was going on inside. It's the silent things that you don't see. At least it gives me a barometer that I am making smarter choices. I am making smarter decisions. You know, if I were to balloon up again back to like 230, 240, well then, pretty safe to say then I'm making bad choices.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Dickie Brennan and Company and Linda Green, the Yakima and Ladies Soul Food Catering. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to executive producer Thomas Walsh and sound engineer Joe Schreiner. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.